I was becoming way too Japanese, and I was fairly narrow, becoming narrow-minded in terms of my view of the world. So they decided that it was time for me to attend international schools, so they put me into St. Mary's. I actually spent a couple of years at St. Mary's and also spent about 2, 3 years in the US for middle school and early parts of high school, and then went back to St. Mary's and finished my K-12 at St. Mary's. So I've had experience with, Japanese elementary school, international school, also American schools, and also American college. So yeah, I've experienced it all, I feel like. And it's been it actually been very interesting because I think it's quite shaped me, shaped who I am today because of that experience. Like, I don't think a lot of people actually go through such different kind of environments in such young ages. So, of course there were challenges that came with that as I was when I was younger, but looking back now as an adult, I feel like all of that is kind of has been a more of a treasure in my life, or like more, a great experience that helped to shape who I am today. So, I actually thank my parents quite a bit for everything they allowed me to experience.
Welcome to episode 64 of Tokyo Alumni Podcast. Today, our guest was born and raised in Japan. He is a graduate of the St. Mary's class of 2007. Unlike many of his peers who attended international school for most of their K through 12 education, he attended Japanese elementary school. After graduating St. Mary's, he attended the University of Washington in Seattle, where he majored in marketing. Missing the amazing food scene of Japan, he quickly returned to Tokyo to start his career at Expedia Group. He spent 7+ years at the company's hotel sales division, where he became one of the youngest area managers in the organization. In 2018, he took an offer from Skyscanner to become one of the commercial leads in charge of the Japanese market. Today, he manages relationships with local airlines and travel agencies. Additional to his full-time job, he recently founded a small side company focused mainly on consulting and investing. On the weekends, you can find him at Tokyo Verity matches, taking photos around the city, or enjoying IPAs at the local breweries. Welcome to the podcast, Sam.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
It's nice to see you in person, sort of.
Yeah, for sure. We've only been speaking on Clubhouse mainly, so
It's a new modality. We're bringing it to the next level now with our faces.
Right.
Audio.
Yeah. And, but it's very nice to meet you face to face for the first time, finally.
Likewise, and hopefully in real person one day.
Yes, for sure. Damn COVID! Once the damn COVID is done with, right?
Yeah, it'll happen. And today, we'll talk a bit about your unique background of being a TCK. We've had a few TCKs, but I don't think we've had many who've gone to Japanese elementary school. So that would be an interesting conversation to have.
Sure.
Talk a little bit about the hotel industry as well as airlines, basically the travel industry in general. And if time permits, we'll move on to things like cryptocurrency and Tokyo Verity, things that I'm quite intrigued myself in. to kick things off, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I was born and raised in Japan. So I actually went to Japanese kindergarten and elementary school until when I was in sixth grade, and my parents decided that I was becoming way too Japanese, and I was fairly narrow, becoming narrow-minded in terms of my view of the world. So they decided that it was time for me to attend international schools, so they put me into St. Mary's. I actually spent a couple of years at St. Mary's and also spent about 2, 3 years in the US for middle school and early parts of high school, and then went back to St. Mary's and finished my K-12 at St. Mary's. So I've had experience with, Japanese elementary school, international school, also American schools, and also American college. So yeah, I've experienced it all, I feel like. And it's been, it actually been very interesting because I think it's quite shaped me, shaped who I am today because of that experience. Like, I don't think a lot of people actually go through such different kind of environments in such young ages. So You know, of course, there were challenges that came with that as I was when I was younger. But, you know, looking back now as an adult, I feel like all of that is kind of has been a more of a treasure in my life, or like a great experience that helped to shape who I am today. So I actually thank my parents quite a bit for everything they allowed me to experience. Yeah, so I went to Nakamachi Shogakko, which is a school in Setagaya, actually a 15-minute walk from where St. Mary's is. So even though, you know, I changed schools, actually kind of the area I was in was about pretty much the same, which made it all more interesting because I'm still in the same neighborhood, but like my life has completely changed as a child. So yeah, that was very interesting.
And where were you in the States?
All right. In the States, I was actually went around. I was in New Orleans for a year. I was in Oklahoma for a year. I was in Seattle for a year before I came back to Japan, and then went back to Seattle for college after I graduated St. Mary's. So the longest I spent was in Seattle.
Wow. So you do have the true firsthand experience to sort of speak about the comparison. So you know, how would you dissect sort of the differences of the three type of schools, the Japanese, international, and American?
It's a really good question. I think, you know, first, I think I would start with the Japanese school. Japanese schools are really good in the sense of education, I feel like, in terms of actually following through with curriculum and being very diligent on what they teach. But at the same time, I felt like, you know, the part of the reason my parents decided to take me out of there was, you know, it's not good or bad, but, you know, a lot of times everybody stopped to kind of think and act a certain way. And I feel like one of the biggest shocks when I went to international school and American school too, was how everybody kind of was very different, and kind of it felt like people were expressing themselves more when I moved to international school and American school. Whereas in Japanese school, everyone was kind of trying to follow order and things like that. You know, maybe I'm exaggerating it a little bit, but, you know, kind of because there's a young as a child memory, but definitely more kind of individuality. I feel like the international schools and American schools care more about your individuality than the Japanese schools did, at least for me. American school and international school, also very different. I feel like at international school, I can speak about St. Mary's, is there's a unique culture, I feel like, that is very specific to potentially Japanese Inta and St. Mary's. Whereas when you go to American school, it's very different. Especially like when I went to school in Oklahoma, I remember I told them I'm from Tokyo, and I said I'm from Japan, and they said, "Oh, Japan, that's the capital of China, right?" And you know, it's just that's kind of like the environment I was in. So people don't really, to them, kind of anybody outside of the US kind of really felt like alien, right? Anyone from a state outside of their state is probably a foreigner to them. And anyone from outside of the country was like an alien, right? So that's kind of how I felt. They didn't really have a reference point to how to deal with me in a sense. So that was very interesting as well. And I think that was probably the toughest in terms of having to adjust in order to create relationships with people, because, you know, very different backgrounds with the people I dealt there. So, you know, it was good that I got to experience that from a young age, because it really allowed me to be able to adapt to the environment that I find myself into, which is, I think, still today one of my strengths, I feel like. So all of that experience is actually extremely valuable, I think. It's very different for sure.
I think what's really interesting is, you know, in this, when it comes to this topic, you know, you and I are in our 30s and a lot of our peers have young children, and maybe, you know, we might one day as well. And I think a big conversation is, do I want to send my kid to Inta? And as you were saying earlier, I mean, you're quite modest to say, you know, you can only really speak on behalf of St. Mary's. And to a certain degree, that's true. But to a certain degree, you know, there are, I think, certain factors that sort of certain factors that overlap, you know, with most international schools get into that next stage of their life, at least around you. What would be your advice in regards to, you know, young parents who are like, do I send my kid to the international schools that obviously have, you know, rigorous and robust curriculum that have high reputation, but are also expensive?
I guess I'll leave out the expensive part, right? Because that one is a factor for sure, right? But that really depends on every individual. So I'll leave that part out. But in terms of whether I would want to send my own kids to international school, the answer will be yes, but with an asterisk. So what I mean by that is, you know, I probably wouldn't want my kid to spend all their education in a Japanese schooling system. And that comes from my own experience, right? And I'm thankful to my parents for taking me out of Japanese schooling system and putting me into an international school. I don't think I'll be here today in the sense of where I am at life if it wasn't for that. So I definitely see the value of giving the same to my children. Now, I wouldn't oppose of the idea of, like, you know, having them go to school outside of Japan and things like that. I think that's an experience in itself. But if I am in Japan when my kids are growing up, I would definitely want them to go to an international school at some stage of their life. Now, when that is the question. And I've had a lot of internal debate on this based on my own experience. And my conclusion as of today is that, you know, sending them to Japanese elementary school when they're young is actually valuable because it helps to strengthen their Japanese core, like language skill wise. You know, I have a lot of friends who went to international school, you do too, all their kind of education. I mean, their Japanese is fine, but it's not sometimes, you know, when they go start working, you know, they face challenges in terms of keigo and like just different kind of manners and things like that, which of course they learn over time. But, you know, that foundation of Japanese, especially if the kid's going to live in Japan, is extremely important. So I do think that until at least third grade or so, I would want my kid to go to Japanese school while kind of having a side education where he or she is kind of getting familiar with English and kind of English curriculum as well, so that when they move to international school, it's not a complete shock, right? So that's kind of what I envision. And I also do want to allow my kid to experience education outside of Japan as well, whether that's, you know, through a boarding school or I don't know, maybe we move to somewhere outside of Japan for a few years. I don't know how we'll do that, but I also see the value in that as well, because, you know, that's what I did in a sense. And it was another kind of layer of different experience that I was able to gain. And I do feel like that will be valuable for my own children as well. So, so that's kind of how I see it in a sense.
When it comes to that overseas experience, what do you think is sort of the catalyst of what the benefit would be for an individual that studies outside of their home country?
I actually think that it's all about being able to adapt, I feel. And what I mean by that is both Japanese schooling system and international schools in Japan are extremely unique in their own cultures, which is great in itself, right? All of them has their pros and cons. I just want my kid to be able to also go outside of that, which is, you know, outside of the scope that is available within Japan, and actually experience a completely different culture in its own. And I feel like the more cultures, the more environments you experience as a young individual, the more open-minded and, you know, you see the world in a different light, I feel like. And I'm not going to get too, like, you know, political or anything like that, but I feel like a lot of the world's issues right now, like, you know, when it comes to, you know, people hating on other certain groups or, you know, we see that commonly in the world today. And I feel like a lot of that comes from just lack of experience with the outside world. Like, everybody's in a bubble. I think, you know, I was in a bubble. I think you were in a bubble. And unless you allow your kids to go out of their own bubbles from a young age, when they're adults, they're going to be scared to get out of that bubble. You know, the longer you keep one person into a bubble, the more, you know, they won't be able to grow out of that kind of way of thought, right? So let's say, as an example, you know, somebody that's been in, because I was in Oklahoma, let's just say Oklahoma, for all their lives, never met a Japanese person, never met, you know, Asians, for example, that's actually from Asia. They wouldn't understand the Asians, right? They wouldn't, you know, there's a lot of the, you know, issues right now in the US in terms of Asian hate and all that. And they just never really experienced it. And for them, one way of thinking was never, they were never given the chance to see what, you know, the other cultures are like and to come to an understanding or be able to mentally accept it, right? So, sorry, I'm kind of going long, but I feel like that the more experience you give your child in terms of different groups, different cultures and things like that, the more they will be flexible and understanding of others. And I think that's a good thing for the child and also for, I think, the world, you know, for people to interact and really understand each other, to see that, you know, what you're seeing on your end is not the full story oftentimes, and other cultures and other people, there's a lot of great things about them, you know, that you just don't know about. So I feel like, yeah, I want my kids to be able to kind of not be stuck in one way of thinking and be able to kind of see the world in a different light.
And I think, you know, that example you sort of painted of the, you know, the Oklahoman, we'll say he's a white person because Oklahoma is primarily white, right? Yeah. You know, I have that image. I think most people do. Or, you know, in Japan, rural, you know, somewhere like Kagoshima, mostly Japanese. But I think you brought up a really excellent point. What I think a lot of people do fail to notice is the bubble of international schools, kids, right? Because it's harder to notice because you might, or there might be a friend group where, you know, there's someone of Indian descent and Asian descent and or East Asian descent. And then, but then everyone is still from like the same school. So one of your sort of worries would be if you do the full span of international school, there is that danger that then you end up going to college, have a roommate who also went to international school, get a job through international school. And then there's that danger of just sort of being stuck in that loop where you're never really out of it. And I think that's a really interesting point. Because as you were saying, it's a bubble and it's fine. Let's say someone does go that route. As you know, you and I probably know people like that. I'm clearly close to that. Cause I do go not to Tokyo, but you know, I'm at an international school myself, but I do appreciate, and I'm sure, you know, you had similar experiences where obviously much greater than me, but my parents did try to push me out, right, to play Japanese soccer teams, you know, go to American summer camps, get out of that international school bubble.
Yeah. It's tough, man. It's really tough, especially when you've been in an international school for all your life. That's the norm. And that's what you associate with. And, you know, even if you're probably in Japan and the regular Japanese people, it feels different to you, right? It's difficult to get out of that unless it's maybe, you know, as a parent, if you push them out, you get hated when you're, you know, a parent, and it's probably, you know, the kid might revolt for a while, but I think, you know, at least from my experience, I mean, not that I would like to push my kid to do everything as I kind of design it, right? Of course, the kid, my kid will be able to choose a lot of things on his or her own, but some of the decisions where they probably will not be able to make based on their life experience at the time, I feel like there is some duty for the parents to even if that means in the short term they're kind of against it, to push them and push them just enough to for them to be able to realize some of these things that I was speaking about. So at least that's how I feel. We'll see how it goes. I'm not a parent yet, so maybe all of this won't work out as I envision it, but
let's see. It's good. We are all thinking about it, especially in grads. It's always, I think, in the back of our mind, like how will, you know, if we have kids or we do have kids, young kids, you know, how will their educational experience transpire? So we'll switch gears now and talk a bit about your professional career. We're just talking off air a bit how early on in your career, you dealt less with airlines, or not at all with airlines, mostly with hotels. So what was that like being, you know, so-called sarariman in Japan, working in the hotel industry?
Yeah, so just to clarify, right, I think, you know, I worked for Expedia for 7 years, which is an American company based, and we had they have a base in Japan, so I worked in their Tokyo office for 7 years, and my job was to work with the local hotels here in Japan to, you know, let's say, get them to sign up to Expedia. So they, you know, they're listed on Expedia for consumers to book, or, you know, work with them to try to, increase their revenue and actually give better kind of prices and product or to the consumers, right? So basically both account managing and also new kind of partner acquisition kind of role. In terms of being salaryman, it's I think everybody has different needs from their job. For me, having had my experience, right, it was difficult for me to envision working in a Japanese company. But I knew that one of my strengths was dealing with Japanese clients potentially, because I have that base in Japanese because I went to Japanese elementary school. And, you know, I think my Japanese for being an Inta kid is extremely strong. And especially when I look like this, right, that actually becomes a strength because, you know, you look foreign, but you're completely fluent in Japanese. And all the clients, you don't need an ice break because I speak, that's ice breaking. Because they're like, whoa, why are you so good in Japanese? So that's been really advantageous, I feel like. But I also didn't want to put myself in too Japanese of an environment, just because I knew that, you know, kind of, how do you say, like, jōge kankē and like all the, I just didn't feel like I would fit in a Japanese company. Not that I couldn't do it, but I felt like, you know, if I worked for a foreign company, I would flourish more. So that's why it just so happened I started working for Expedia. I wasn't really looking to get into travel per se immediately. It just so happened that that was the company that, you know, in terms of environment and in terms of the experience that, you know, I was kind of seeking out of my first job, it was the best match. So I decided to work for Expedia, and it was great, man. I mean, right now with COVID, travel industry is a little tricky, you know, not tricky, but it's tough times for travel industry, especially now with the Olympics inbound tourists coming to Japan being officially kind of blocked in a sense. It's a very sad time for the travel industry in Japan. But, you know, over the 7 years I was at Expedia is when, you know, Olympics was decided. So there was a lot of new hotels kind of being built across Japan, and the hotels were, you know, really trying to increase their foreign customer share, because they want, you know, the domestic travel is extremely large in Japan. But in terms of the population, as we all know, it's decreasing. And, you know, we anticipate that over the next 10 to 30 years, domestic travel is going to decrease in terms of volume. So how is, you know, Japanese hotels planning to survive? A lot of them were looking at inbound tourism as the next thing, right? And it was really flourishing over the 7 years I was there. The growth in terms of foreign travelers coming to Japan was phenomenal. And a lot of hotels that, you know, even previously were against having foreigners in their hotels, and they just were strictly domestic, started to shift focus and really, you know, get more foreigners to stay in their hotels. And so that was really exciting time that I was at Expedia. And it's really unfortunate today that because of COVID, you know, all those hotels who were relying on international guests are now suffering quite a bit. You know, who could have foreseen that, unfortunately, but yeah, when I was there, it was really exciting times.
It's interesting hearing how much you liked your first job, because, you know, you hear so much about people not liking their first jobs.
I was fortunate. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the average, I think they say millennial stays 3 years at their first post, but you stayed for 7 years. Yes. And you mentioned earlier, you know, it was a very purposeful decision to not go Nikkei and go Gaishi. So were you quite adamant when you were job hunting that it had to be Gaishi?
Yes. Yes. Mm. I wasn't so adamant about the industry. I was more adamant that, you know, you had to be Gaishi, and the culture, the company culture had to be, I wouldn't say foreign, but like, you know, open-minded and, you know, less hierarchy and all that. So that was important to me, yeah. And I wanted to do sales kind of role because I believe that, you know, dealing with people is extremely important as a skill. And I wanted to become if I could become a good salesperson, then, you know, that creates the foundation of my rest of my life, I felt like. So that's why, you know, those two things matched quite well at Expedia for me.
And then you move on to Skyscanner. So still similar industry, but you're working more with airlines. It must be crazy time right now. So how did everything sort of transpire for you back in, you know, the start of last year?
I mean, now I deal mainly with airlines and also travel agencies. So Skyscanner is a meta, what we call meta site, essentially, you know, comparison site. So you can come to Skyscanner and kind of, let's say if you're flying from Tokyo to Seoul, you know, find your flight and see each of the sites, how much each site is selling that ticket for, and choose the one that best fits you. But, you know, it's been a very interesting year, very difficult year for sure. International travel is pretty much dead. I mean, it's not completely dead, but very minimum activity. You know, of course, all the airlines that were, you know, kind of flying those international routes had to either stop or go on a very limited schedule. And even those flights are not filled at all. So, you know, it's extremely tough times for the airlines. They're bleeding money in a sense. You know, they have all these employees. They being able to generate revenue from international travel. So, and even domestic travel, even though it hasn't been hit as hard as international travel, with state of emergency and all of that, you know, there's been big waves of kind of shift in terms of demand. For example, after the first state of emergency, basically the figures just plummeted to, you know, pretty much nothing. And it recovered during the summer, especially with the GoTo campaign that the government did. There were demand in terms of domestic travel. So in the summertime, it was okay. But again, after the summer period in the winter, when, you know, COVID cases started to increase again, unfortunately, demand started to plummet again. So it's been a challenging year for sure. And of course, there's a lot of travel companies which has been affected by this and, you know, either have gone bankrupt or had to cut a lot of people. So I would say, you know, after initial 5-6 months or so, I was actually a little worried as well, you know, especially considering the market. But fortunately for us, we've been able to kind of ride through the difficult times for now. And, you know, we are very optimistic as a company that demand will come back. And once it does, if the vaccine rollout it goes well and it's effective and, you know, life starts to get back to some level of, I would say there will be a potential kind of bubble in terms of travel, because a lot of people, I'm sure you too, Nick, but are itching to travel. I am itching to travel. I think everybody I know are itching to travel. And the moment that becomes okay to do, you will see a lot of people just going crazy with their travel plans. But what I pray and hope is that until then, all the airlines, all the major travel agencies, we can all kind of survive and ride through this wave so that when that time comes, you know, we can be there for the consumers and we can be there for them to make their bookings and, you know, purchases easy. And yeah, it's tough times, but we're not losing hope, you know. Travel is an essential need for human being, is what I truly believe. It's just like eating. It's just like sleeping. People can't not travel. So it will come back.
It seems like people are sort of crudely reminded through this, you know, COVID, you said the necessity to travel. And, you know, when it comes to these airlines sort of so-called surviving, you know, there was tremendous stimulus bills passed, at least in the U.S. for, you know, U.S. companies like Delta, United, and so on, and tens of billions. How does a government or has there been any government support in regards to the sort of the players that are not airline industries but related, like the Skyscanners and the Expedias and whatnot?
I think the biggest support in terms of non-airlines has been the GoTo campaign. And that GoTo campaign was designed to try to, I mean, of course, it doesn't help international travel, unfortunately. In terms of domestic travel, GoTo campaign actually did have an effect in terms of increasing demand during the summer periods. You know, the travel industry desperately needed. So it wasn't really, I wouldn't say a direct form of kind of support, but by giving that discount to consumers and allowing them to travel for extremely cheap. I don't know, a lot of my friends, I actually didn't get a chance to travel last summer, but a lot of my friends took advantage of it and they went all over the place. So, and they were just telling me how crazy cheap it was. And, you know, I think that was extremely helpful for the industry. Now, I would say so.
That's interesting to hear from you because, you know, there was pretty scathing criticism at first, right, about, you know, letting people travel, but
it's a tough balance, right? Like, obviously, you don't want to go to travel to be the cause of another outbreak and, you know, people having to stay home. So I can't really comment whether that was the right thing to do from, you know, a pandemic perspective. But at least from the tourism industry perspective, it was definitely helpful for many of the hotels and travel agencies. But, you know, not that I didn't have my complaints. There were some things that, for example, at Skyscanner, we're very one of our biggest strengths is flight bookings, right? And for GoTo, flight only was not part of the campaign, so you had to book as a package. So that was something that a lot of like flight only players in the industry were extremely upset about. So there were issues with the campaign itself in terms of how it was designed. But the intent and the actual effect was not insignificant.
That's intriguing to hear, you know, firsthand from someone in the business about the GoTo. And, you know, outside of this work you've done with the hotels and flights, you do your own business. Can you tell us a little bit about the business that you've started?
Yeah, so it's just a really side thing, you know. My main focus is still at Skyscanner, obviously, but as a side thing, I've started a small, very very small company, which is run by me, myself, and I. essentially, kind of the purpose of the company was I've always wanted to eventually be self-employed. So this is like my first step in trying for that. We'll see how it goes. I've literally just created the company end of last year, so still very, very young. But yeah, so one of my main things that I'm planning right now as part of the company's work is to, my father does retail business. I'm trying to help kind of bring his shop into more 21st century level. You know, he's great businessman in terms of, you know, He has a lot of experience, but internet is not one of the things that he's per se biggest strength. So as part of my first role in the company, I'll be kind of consulting and supporting his online e-commerce business is the plan. So that's what I'll be doing. So that's going to be the main kind of first project as part of the company. But other than that, I've also been doing some investing as part of the company as well. It just so happened that when I created the company, it kind of aligned with when I was really kind of started to get interested in cryptocurrency. I felt like there was a lot of opportunity there. So I started investing in crypto as a company. And so far, that's kind of ended up delaying my planning for my dad's side of the business, unfortunately, because there's been so much action happening in the crypto side of things in the last few months. But it's basically right now, those are the two main things I'm focusing on as part of the company. And I envision more in the future, assuming those things go well. I'm also interested in real estate and things like that. Hopefully in the future, we'll get involved in more different kind of fields of business.
Yeah, it seems like Bitcoin, it was obviously really big. I'd say a few years ago, right, when it first hit 10K and I think about 15K back then. And now, obviously, as we speak today, I want to say it's 55,000, 56,000. I when I speak to people, maybe every other person I speak to either has no idea what a Bitcoin is, or they are just highly skeptical. They say, well, it has no value. So what would be sort of your, 30-second to 1-minute retort to someone who says to you, well, Bitcoin's got no value, man. Like, you're going to lose all your money.
Before I start my 30-second, I'll say that I'm still very much baby in this world. So probably listeners of this podcast, there will be many, many people who are way more experienced and, knowledge about Bitcoin and crypto in general. But I guess if I had to kind of sell it in 30 seconds to a minute, I would say, in terms specific to Bitcoin, think of it as digital gold, right? So yeah, why I'm bullish on Bitcoin is, I don't know if it's the right thing to say, but it's because of COVID. And why that is because of COVID, there's been a lot of money printing being done by different governments, including Japan and the US, to pay for a lot of the initiatives they're doing. And even though we don't feel it today in terms of inflation or anything like that, not yet, I do feel like the amount that they've printed will start to affect the value of the currency we hold. So let's say if you have, 10,000 USD, the value of that 10,000 USD today versus a few years from now may be very different potentially. And I feel like that is a real potential risk in the world right now. And why people buy gold, why people buy silver is because they believe that's a hedge against inflation, right? And I feel like specific to Bitcoin, that Bitcoin can be that hedge that is more easily accessible and purchasable than a gold or silver. Like if you want to buy gold or silver, it's extremely difficult. And there's a lot of middleman that takes a lot of margin, right? But Bitcoin, as long as you have a computer and internet, anybody can buy anywhere in the world. So imagine if you're in third world country where, the value of your currency just keeps depreciating, right, over the next few years. What are they going to do? What are they going to do to try to protect themselves? Are they going to go buy gold? Or do you think that they'll buy Bitcoin because it's so much more easier to buy online? And I feel like Bitcoin is going to even potentially replace gold in the future, in terms of that ultimate hedging investment is my bet on Bitcoin. So I don't know if that actually becomes true. Maybe there'll be problems with Bitcoin in the future and this whole theory crumbles and, my bet doesn't work. But I do feel like there's still a lot of potential for Bitcoin and we're just getting started. Even though, it's right now it's quite bubbling, and I'm sure there's going to be ups and downs going forward. But in the extreme long run, I think the next 5-10 years, like even the people I know around me, not many people are like even thinking about Bitcoin or crypto today. Even though it's bubbled already, it's gone from, as you said, from like 10K to at one point 60K in a matter of months, right? That's crazy. But even then, no, a lot of people are still not paying attention. And I feel like the real surge in value will come when Bitcoin becomes kind of like a household thing, right? Everybody knows about Bitcoin and it becomes a standard kind of part of the kind of investment portfolio for everybody. And I don't think we're anywhere close to that yet, but I'm betting that that's going to happen in the long run.
Well, that was definitely over 1 minute, but I'll accept that as a retort.
Sorry.
I feel you.
Can cut it. You can cut it. You can cut it. I failed this test. You can cut it.
Oh, no. It's fine. I think I'm going to include all of this part right now.
Oh, no.
But no, it's definitely an intriguing topic. And what's funny is, but yeah, very, very interesting stuff. It'll be definitely interesting to watch this podcast 5 years from now. And either we'll be like, whoa, he's saying the right thing, or you know, we don't know, oh, right? Yeah.
So if I'm off on this, what I'll do is I'll request you to delete the video.
Oh, yeah, I'll just mysteriously disappear from the internet.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So, yeah, as we sort of wrap up things towards the end here, I think we have a little bit of time to maybe explore a passion we both have. And you're the first Tokyo Verity fan. So for listeners, you know, for our three listeners or something at this point, can you tell us a little bit about what is Tokyo Verity? And when did you start supporting Tokyo Verity? And when I used to go to the games, there weren't many non-Japanese fans. So, no. You know, you're probably one of the few ones.
Yeah, Tokyo Verity is a football club based in Tokyo. They are actually the first professional football club in Japan. Founded in 1969. And when the J-League started in 1993, they were one of the most glorious teams in Japan. They won the first 2 years of J-League. They had many household name players like, you know, Kazu and Ramos and all those players. And, you know, but that was kind of the peak of the club's success, unfortunately. And ever since then, you know, ever since 2006 or so, we've been mainly in the Division 2, which is the second division in Japan. So we're not in the first division right now. But yeah, so that's Verdi. And why I started liking Verdi was, you know, it was basically, you know, when I was in elementary school, J-League started. And I actually really liked their mascot. That was the first thing. And I liked the color green. Which is Verdi's main color. And it just kind of happened that the players I ended up liking in the Japan national team, like Kazu and Kitazawa at the time, were also playing for Verdi. So it just kind of aligned for me to start liking Verdi as a young kid. And I tend to be quite a loyal person. When I start liking something, I like it a lot. And, you know, once I kind of started to support Verdi, there was no turning back, even if they fell to second division and, you know, they've been quite crappy in terms of play for the last whatever many years, and doesn't matter. Like for me, that's my club now. And that's kind of, you know, I love soccer or football. That's my biggest passion, I think, outside of work or not work, but kind of my biggest passion overall is to watch football. It's just, I love it.
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's a very unique team. It kind of reminds me of Leeds in England, right? At one point, right, they were sort of the belle of the ball, and now they've been Division Two. And yeah, you mentioned earlier, you know, Rui Ramos, right, is one of their sort of main players in the 90s. I recall his son attended St. Mary's, yes, and I have this vague memory. He played middle school soccer. Was he about the same year as you, or maybe a year younger?
Yeah, yeah. He was, I think in terms of age, he was a year older than I was. I didn't really hang out with him or, like, you know, talk to him very much. But yeah, he was at St. Mary's.
Yeah, that's my memory of Ramos as his son playing Ace IJ.
Yeah,
you're wearing green today, representing Verity. Good to see.
Yes. Yes.
And I think this takes us right towards the end here, where at the very end, I like to ask the guest what is coming up in their lives in the next few years, next few decades. So if you'd like to share with us, what's to come?
Yeah. So a lot is actually coming. I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I started the company. So that's going to be exciting as a side thing. I got married last year started a family, and you know, hopefully in the future we'll have kids. And we're just as we speak right now, we actually committed to buying a dog just yesterday. So
nice.
We are going to have our official new family joining us soon. Life is, you know, changing very rapidly. So just enjoying the ride, and hopefully, you know, Bitcoin also flies higher too.
To the moon.
Hopefully. Yes, to the moon. Yeah.
Well, you know, it was great talking to you. I know it's not in person, but honestly, this feels like in person for me, because this is just the way I do the podcast. And it's been nice talking to you. And yeah, thanks.
Likewise, man. Thanks for having me. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, likewise. And I'll see you around in Clubhouse, and maybe at the Tokyo State. I guess it's now Ajinomoto.
Ajinomoto, yes. Okay. So whenever you can travel back to Tokyo, you gotta come see me at the stadium. So
sounds good. Thank you, bud. That was episode 63 with Sam, and have a nice night.